April 23rd, the year 3030. When I wake, Rustin has already moved on to the next door, and I can hear its being pounded reverberate through the walls of my own room. I stretch, my body feeling light after sleep that could be described best as floating, a suspension in dreams. The bed gives way so easily to the weight of me, it feels like what I would imagine clouds to feel if I could touch them. I crawl out of the bed and try to peek out under the window covering to the outside, but it's still dark out, and the bright letters on the building across the street have ceased to glow. As far as I can tell, no one is walking along the street below, and so I start exploring my room in more detail instead. There's an extra room, I find, a washroom. There are many things I learned at the Constitute. We were introduced to showers, though they were basic compared to these. The water was always cold, but it was easier than trekking down to the river to bathe. While the Constitute had outhouses, much like the rest of the UCOA, we were taught about toilets in our ancient history class. But they were fabled, something so strange and wonderful that none of us could actually imagine them. No more running out in the middle of the night or during a snowstorm. It seemed to us a fantastical thing, the sheer convenience of it. I stare at the toilet, white, shiny, and slowly lift the lid. I spend far too long in the steamy heat of the shower, and when I leave the room, I find that everyone else is already milling about. Just as I leave my room, Rustin appears and signals for us to follow him down.
You sleep okay?
Liam asks, appearing next to me out of thin air.
Yeah,
I say, before I can stop myself. Then I turn and walk away, finding Clancy and Aileen near where the guard is sitting.
What did he want?
Clancy asks, not looking towards Liam.
Good morning, I reply, and then, to see how I slept.
What a considerate man,
Clancy says, almost with a snarl.
So I take it you and Liam aren't a thing anymore.
Aileen gives me a cursory glance.
Trust me, I wouldn't, I say to her. You know, even though everyone always had a thing for him, and sorry if I say this because you actually did have a thing with him, but for some reason, he always gave me the creeps.
Clancy and I exchange a glance that Aileen can't help but notice, but before she can ask for details, we are herded down to the cold, cave-like room below where the van dropped us off. Unlike the night before, it isn't completely empty, and we can make out figures on the other side of the vast area as they leave their own, smaller vans and head in. Rustin seems ill at ease and quickly makes us get into the van. The partition goes halfway up, and then, much to our surprise, Rustin opens the front door and gets behind the wheel.
You're going to take us, sir?
Stella's voice sounds like she's trying to remind Rustin that he's mixed up about the situation, and that surely we are waiting for the driver to arrive.
Yes, I have a license to drive in Europa.
Rustin looks annoyed by Stella's remark and glowers coldly through a mirror to look at us.
Besides, the driver couldn't make it today, so we don't have a choice.
It's still dark out, but since Rustin has to keep an eye on us and keep the partition down, we catch glimpses of the dark streets outside, but they are still too dark to draw any conclusions about the city itself. The ride to wherever we're going is anything but smooth. Rustin can drive, but his turns are very wide. His stopping the car ends in a stuttering more often than not. He lets out little curses that we can barely make out and that greatly amuse us. He's driving so slowly that we are in no real danger. And so, by the time we get to what we can only assume is the briefing, we are all trying hard not to laugh, our faces pinched.
We're here.
Rustin lets out a relieved grunt and stops the vehicle. Then he gets out to open up the side door and let us out. We're standing in a field with hard gray ground beneath our feet, like the one used for aeroplane landings.
Lines are drawn onto it, and I can see that Rustin has stopped the van above one of these white lines.
I'll fix the parking later, Rose. Now let's go. You all have a very long day ahead of you.
For some reason, he sounds annoyed by this, and we can hear him grumble something about,
damn Europeans and their soft egg integration welcome wagon routine.
We enter into a building, equally clean as the rooms we stayed in last night, spotless as everything here seems to be, and trail after Rustin as he walks with quick, short steps to the end of the hallway and then points for us to enter. As we go in, we can hear a burst of loud, delighted laughter.
Ah, yes, here they are.
The voice is slightly accented, but it is in our native tongue.
We are so excited you are here, and we appreciate you.
The tall man is standing at the front of a large, white, windowless room. His pants are an incredible green, and I do a double take. His shirt is plain white, but on top of it, he's wearing a scarf of many colors, knotted around his torso, looping around his body randomly.
Hello, Lars. It's good to see you.
Rustin shakes the tall man's hand, and they smile at each other.
Can you brief them on the mission?
Rustin looks at us and smiles encouragingly. His annoyance has vanished upon seeing Lars, it seems.
That sounds great.
Lars beckons us to sit in the chairs at the other end of the room.
First of all, welcome. You're in the city of Minga, the capital of Germania. And the reason you were selected is because you are either very good at carrying small vials or because you are able to blend into an unknown situation very easily.
Some of us cock our heads at this, as we realize that this is what the strangers were doing at the Constitute.
You were able to assimilate into an unknown situation without being detected, which is very important for our mission.
Here, Lars gets serious. He runs a large hand through his almost ashen-colored hair. Rustin looks at him and nods as if to say, it's okay to tell the children what we've discussed. Lars pulls a small box from his pants and hits a button. A map appears on the wall behind him, and Rustin and him step away so we can get a better look. The map is the same we were shown at the Constitute. On the left side, the UCOA, its slim sliver of a shape along the coast of a giant land. Above us, Kanda, large and sprawling, all the way across to the other coast. Across the ocean, and at this point I fully realize for the first time that I actually am across the ocean, drawn on the map, lies Europa along the western coast. To the northeast are the United Pacific Nations, their reach vast and sprawling. I can't help but notice that there is a landmass just below Europa that hasn't been shown to us before. Just a little nub beneath the edge of Hispani. But Lars is staring at us now, and the room goes quiet as we meet his gaze in anticipation.
A few years ago, Germanian anthropologists, scientists who dig up and study ancient artifacts, were searching an ancient city along the edges of a primeval coal mine. One day, while they were digging, one of the scientists came across something strange. An inexplicably glowing metal that was deep within the earth. At first, the archaeologists thought nothing of it. They found four small pebbles of the material, and they simply bagged and tagged it with all the other things they had found. Plates and vases and whatever else within the ancient city they were digging up. They showed the locals to see if they knew what it was, and the locals called it Pingy because of its glow.
Rustin chimes in.
Yes,
Lars goes on. It has a pink glow, which is why we call it Pinkdom. The scientists returned to Germania and handed the material off to the geologists at the University of Minga, but none of them knew what it was. So the Pinkdom started to make its way through the different departments, until one day it ended up in the physics department, where it just so happened that a nuclear physicist named Bastner was.
The tests are still ongoing.
Rustin adds and folds his arms over his chest.
But we do know that the Pinkdom could possibly produce a large amount of energy. Clean energy.
That's right. Lars nods, excited. We don't completely understand how it works yet, but Dr. Basna and her team have been able to measure a huge energy output from the material. Under the Treaty of Epizo, Energy use is very tightly regulated, as you know better than anyone, having lived your whole lives under its restrictions. The Pinkdom might change all of that. It might lift the energy restrictions, if it is done correctly. At this, Lars and Rustin look at each other, and a blip of despair passes through the air between them. The Treaty of Epizo mandates that all nations share in the burden, as well as the sources of energy in the world. Any violation of this means a violation of the treaty and possible war with the country in violation. Suddenly, Lars looks stricken as he goes on. The Pacific United Nations are the strongest in the world, with the largest military. But they must still adhere to the rules of the treaty. We have to keep the peace. But just over a year ago, a man named Niccolo Palim ran for the president of Northern Pacific Nation and won. His campaign strategy was that he would secure the Pinkdom and only let his country use it. Don't the people in his country not want peace? Aileen asks, incredulous. Maybe, Lars answers, but they want unlimited energy more. To not have to count how many hours a day they left the lights on, or how long they cooked their food, or how many miles they drove in their car would make life easier. Energy is freedom. So what happened after Palim won? I stare at Lars, wanting him to go on. Lars leans his head to one side and then the other, like he's weighing the question, how to give the correct answer to this. It's not good, he says carefully. The Northern Pacific Union has been trying to intimidate Germania into giving them the Pinkdom. In response, the Southern Pacific Nation has decided to separate from them, at least until they stop pushing us. Despite of this, there have been acts of war, mostly in the form of aeroplane battles that have taken place as far away as the coasts of the UCOA, but also in the Southern Pacific regions, to the point that small towns were bombed and required aid. In light of these events, we have decided it's probably best to just remove the source of the problem, to remove the Pinkdom from Germania before the Northern Pacific nations can get their hands on it.
Where's the Pinkdom now?
Liam asks, leaning forward in a seat like he's ready to inhale the answer. In a secure location. Lars answers offhandedly. But tomorrow we are going to move it out of the country. The screen behind him changes again, and Lars points to it. From where we are now, Minga, here, he gestures to a dot on the map. We will transport the vials of Pinkdom through the mountains of Austria and to Lickenai, posing as a hiking group. From Lickenai, we will be driven to the coast of Portua, and then we'll undertake a 7-day boat ride that will bring us to Antigua Scotia. The Canada government has agreed to keep the Pinkdom safe until we can broker an agreement with the Northern Pacific Nation on how to use it safely and equally.
And no one knows that we're moving it out of the country?
Clancy asks. Lars grins. No one. Starting tomorrow, we are going to be the only people in the world who know where the Pinkdom is.
I know this is a great responsibility,
Rustin says and goes to stand beside Lars, as the wall behind them goes blank.
But you were chosen because I believe that any one of you could bring the Pinkdom to where it needs to be, completely on your own. If anything were to happen to me on this mission, the Pinkdom will be transported by the next person in line.
Who comes after you?
Liam asks, with a cocky smile on his face.
I believe it will be apparent when the time comes. Now, weren't you going to take them out on the town today?
Rustin says, turning to Lars and not quite answering the question.
Ah, yes, of course.
Lars walks to a panel next to the door, hitting a button. Please bring in the clothes now, Kurt.
Klaro,
a voice replies, and a few minutes later, we're still sitting very stiffly in our seats, a long rack of colorful garments are rolled into the room. Please pick your favorite and meet me at the front entrance. We want to make sure you blend in here. Lars grins and walks off. All of us walk over to the clothes and let the deep reds and bright violets run through our fingers, the colorful strips of scarf-like fabric that everyone seems to be wearing in knots around their upper bodies, including Kurt, his own in a deep, dark blue.
What are you picking?
Liam has once again snuck up beside me. but this time I'm not groggy anymore, and I simply move away from him. The fact that he thinks I can just forget about what happened makes me feel deeply uneasy, and I slide into a conversation with Blair and Aileen about whether she should pick a rose or green-colored scarf. When we're all changed and ready to go, we tromp down the hallway, almost proud. It's hard to be worried about global tensions when you've just put on the silliest outfit of your life. The clothes are bright and beautiful, and we're giddy, covered in color like this. We almost bounce down the hall to meet Lars at the front door.
You ready to immerse yourself in Minga?
Lars grins, and we can't help but laugh, our fears exhaled and pushed out of our minds for now.
There are three languages that are spoken here. Lucky for you, one of them is yours, due to ancient tradition. The other two are Germanica and Choma. If anyone talks to you in one of those languages, do what you did in your challenge and blend in. Or, you know, pretend like you're already too drunk to talk.
Already too drunk to talk?
Clancy looks at me and furrows his brow.
What exactly are we doing today?
Lars opens up the door, and the streets, that just a couple hours earlier were completely empty, are bustling with life. People are everywhere, dressed in splashes of color, and loud conversations wash over us, some of which I can understand and some that I cannot. But all of them ring beautiful in my ear. The immensity of it alone makes me giddy, makes me want to explore all of it. We walk along giant streets that are paved with cobbled stones, as Lars explains under his breath, like he's feeding us the most intimate secrets of his life. There are people laughing at tables outside everywhere, drinking beer and eating, and the smells of everything are both sweet and strange, and sometimes putrid without warning. Lars takes us to what he calls his favorite Bavara brunch bar, and we gorge ourselves on sausages grown in tubes, as Lars explains, that are wrapped in seaweed that we recognize, something called brat sushi. We drink the clearest beer we have ever tasted. It's almost as if we're drinking sweetened water, and it goes down quick and easy. After brunch, we wander the streets of the city, where street vendors offer us colorful radios and caged green birds without wings. Lars shows us the river of the city, where people are bathing, but dressed in colorful underwear. He shows us an ancient church, making us hurry down many tight streets so we don't miss it, to where we finally stand, gasping, in a large open square. And little doors open high up on the church roof to let out little tiny men and women that twirl and dance to the music played with bells that fills the air. As the day winds down, Lars takes us to a movie play, where we finally can sit and rest a moment. In the dark room, we must all sit quietly, which is hard because the beer flows freely even here, as waiters duck out of view and silently bring us refills when anyone hits a button on the seat. The movie play is wonderful, and it is centered around the story of a couple that is on a great adventure together. The scenes are half on the screen and half played out by the people watching, as we come to find out. The first time it happens, the screen freezes, just as the man and the woman have jumped off a cliff and are flying through the air, mouths opening wide as they are about to scream. A man appears on the screen, giant, from the shoulders up only, and tells us he is the director of this movie play, and he hopes that we are enjoying the show. He tells us that two actors are needed for the second screen, and if you don't want to participate, just hit the red button on your seat now. But none of us can locate the red button, both because all the beer we've been drinking and because of the novelty of this experience. And so the seats of a man behind us and the seat Stella is sitting in light up in a bright green circle, and two large beams of light appear, one to illuminate the stage and the other to show the stairs leading up to it. The man behind us lets out a loud whooping sound and runs up on stage, and so Stella, blending in as we had been told to, runs up after him.
Now,
the giant director on the screen instructs them, looking down at the stage, as if he can see them standing there before him, looking back up at him.
I want you to scream as loudly as you can as I play very dramatic music. Scream as if you really did just jump off a cliff to escape grave danger and are about to land in the ocean, my dear actors. Stella and the stranger stare at each other, giddy, and they can't help but laugh. The screen lights up with the number 3 and beeps, then the number 2 and beeps again, then 1, and then both the man and Stella scream at the top of their lungs, stretching their arms up overhead as if they are truly falling from a cliff into the ocean, as a loud, dramatic overture plays along to their voices, and the entire theater erupts in raucous laughter. After 5 seconds of screaming, the director appears once more on the screen, thanks them for their participation, and then says, "Now back to the movie." Just as Stella and the man rush back to their seats, the couple in the movie hits the water, and the theater erupts in applause, but then just as quickly returns to silence to not disturb the next scene. The next movie theater scene acted out by the audience includes Blair racing a little girl back and forth across the stage, though he pretends to be very slow and lets her win, as per the director's instruction. Aileen and another woman have to act out a teary separation as the man is taken captive while the woman hides among the branches of a tree. Aileen gives such an impeccable, tearful, almost wistful performance, and the entire theater is almost brought to tears by her played grief. Finally, the couple is reunited at the end of the movie, and they are running towards each other, arms spread wide, ready to embrace each other, and we all suspect that this will be a romantic scene, as the director gives us the option to hit the red button, with the warning that this specific scene may include some mouth-to-mouth, as he puts it. I look around to see what the others are doing. Clancy, who is sitting 2 seats over from me, hits the red button as discreetly as possible. I can see the parents of several young girls and boys hit the button for them with a stern look on their faces. When I see that Liam doesn't hit the red button, I quickly turn to hit mine, but it's too late. As I'm still staring down at the button, my seat lights up in the green circle, and I realize I've been chosen to act out the mouth-to-mouth romantic scene. Shit. Everyone around us hollers and cheers. I look to see if Liam's seat is circled by the green light, but when our eyes meet, his face is grim, and I realize only the light of the screen illuminates his face. 2 seats over from his, I see the green glow, and I realize it is Lars whose seat has lit up. This revelation brings both relief and the opposite of relief, since I've known Lars for mere hours. But trying to be a good agent of the UCOA means blending in, and so I stand, somewhat hesitantly, which makes the audience let out further hoots and lots of laughter. Both Lars and I walk to the stage and stand opposite each other, bashful as teenagers. "Now," the director on the screen says, "you have traversed a desert to find one another. You have crawled through caves and jumped off cliffs to be with your one and only true love." Here, both Lars and I can't help but let out nervous laughter, and the audience echoes the sentiment. "She has just rescued you," the director goes on, "and you have never felt more full of passion and love and desire. So now, please, kiss." The screen goes black. Soft, sweet music starts to drift up around the stage, and for a second I forget that this is where I am, that I am standing in front of close to 100 people in a dark room, but instead focus on Lars, who is standing before me, at first awkwardly moving his arms at his sides, but then looks back at me and freezes. The awkwardness falls away. A strange thing grips my chest, and when he starts taking the few steps that divide us, I realize the strange thing has taken a hold of him as well. I look up into his gray eyes,
and for a moment I think I would like to pretend that it's all true. That he is my true love, and that I have fought for him, and that this is a reunion of shared souls. He bends down towards me, and the beer in our bodies makes it easier, and I lean towards him as well, letting my lips part. When we touch, the thing that's taken a hold of both of us draws us together. Our bodies lean into one another with instant longing, and once I start kissing him, I don't want to stop. Laughter starts to echo around us, and we realize the music has stopped and that we are still standing close, embracing one another.
Nunke Fang Cheng!
Someone calls out, and we separate, awkwardly giving more space than needed. We slowly make our way back to our seats, and I can make out Liam, glaring at Lars, as I pass him to sit back down. The movie ends, and Lars announces that we're going to go to what is called a discoteca. Both of us make sure there is as much distance as possible between us as we walk along the streets. Dusk starts to settle onto the city.
Are you, like, into that guy?
Liam asks from somewhere behind me. We are straggling behind the rest of the group.
Liam, don't talk to me.
I speed up, but Liam grabs my arm and pulls me back. The distance between us and the rest of the group grows.
Let go of me, Liam!
I try to pull my arm back, but his nails dig into my skin, and I relent as it stings. Everything okay here? Aileen has trailed back and is now standing between us and the group, where both Clancy and Blair have noticed something is wrong and have stopped, calling to the others to wait up.
Yeah, we're fine,
Liam says gruffly and releases my arm. I feel my skin, and there are nail marks pressed into it. Liam stalks off and rejoins the group.
Let's go. I want to go see what this discoteca is all about,
he says, trying to distract them. The group keeps moving, but Lars drifts back to where Aileen and I are walking at the tail end, and Aileen strides ahead to give us space.
What was he doing?
Lars asks, looking truly perplexed.
Aren't you all from the same organization?
We are, but I don't think he likes me very much. Or any more. Or too much, I think to myself, wishing I had never taken up with Liam in the first place. I try to put on a brave smile, but Liam is starting to truly unnerve me, and even as the ache in my arm is receding, I feel rattled.
It's okay. I will make sure he doesn't hurt you,
Lars says, smiling widely. Thanks, but I can take care of myself, I reply without hesitation. At this, he laughs.
I'm sure you can, but just in case, I will stay near you, not just for your sake, but for mine. I'm supposed to watch all of you, and if I don't do a good job, Rustin will shoot me.
He says this with a truly terrified expression on his face. Fine. You can stick near me, but it's for your safety, not mine, I say, and let my hand brush up against his.